Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Bray. As regular listeners know, these Soapbox editions of the show are wholly sponsored. That means everyone you hear in one of these podcasts paid to be here. And I got to say, we're on a bit of a roll with the soapboxes lately. The last one was with HD Moore talking about Rumble, which was awesome. And in this edition, we've got a fun one for you as well. Ryan Callumber is the Executive Vice President of Cybersecurity Strategy at Proofpoint, which is a company best known as being an email filtering giant. They do other stuff as well, but yeah, email is what they're best known for. And of course, Proofpoint's biggest challenger in the space is Microsoft. If you've been paying attention, you'd know that Microsoft is doing an absolutely massive push into the security space. It claims security is a $10 billion revenue center for the company. All this while the very security products they sell are largely designed to mitigate all their weird design decisions and bad defaults in their core products, not to mention all the OneDrive and like Office 365 platform abuse. And largely that's what this interview is about: the screwy incentives that are driving Microsoft's decision making. More emphasis on product development and less on securing its core products. It's not great. Now, in response to this situation, a bunch of companies have actually formed an alliance to combat Microsoft's security business, to take it on. The Spectra Alliance consists of Okta, CrowdStrike, Proofpoint, and Netskope, and its aim is to cooperate and integrate and sort of take on Redmond, particularly that sort of E5 all-you-can-eat licensing arrangement that they've come up with. So, of course, it is self-serving for Ryan and Proofpoint to give Microsoft a kicking, which he does. Believe me, he does, given that Microsoft is Proofpoint's primary competitor. But the thing is, he makes good points. So yeah, in this interview, we talk about the incentives thing, and then we talk about why Active Directory is a trash fire, and why the replication of the domain trust model in Azure AD is eventually going to bite us all in the ass as well. The Circle of Life, Enterprise Computing Fail Edition. Oh, and fun fact, Microsoft has just announced it's upping its prices pretty much across the board, across all licensing tiers. But anyway, I will drop you in here. This is Ryan Callumber, EVP of Cybersecurity Strategy at Proofpoint, talking Microsoft.
What becomes really interesting, though, from a security person's perspective, is that you're dependent on Microsoft in lots of different ways in most roles, whether you want to be or not. And it's an evolution, obviously, that started back in the 90s when it was just very easy to hate Microsoft. In the early 2000s, we could almost laugh at their incompetence before they started focusing on this. Then briefly and somewhat oddly, they kind of became the good guys for a while, at least a very brief while. And then we got buried under everything from Print Nightmare and Proxy Logon to, you know, everything that's happened really over the last 12 months that's kind of flipped the script again. And that progression is a bizarre one for the industry, because you don't really have another industry where the arsonist is also the fire department under the same aegis. Like, it's a very, very strange dynamic.
Well, I remember a few years ago, I started seeing reports of people having bad bug reporting experiences with MSRC, right? And the feedback that I got, and we did not want to kick the crap out of them at that point, because they had actually a pretty decent track record of being quite responsive and doing the right things. And, you know, it was one of those things where you're looking at this as someone like me, a podcast host covering this stuff every week, and you think, gee, that's weird, but that looks like an anomaly. And the feedback seemed to be that, you know, resource constraints are sort of applying everywhere, and MSRC might have been a bit under-resourced at that time and whatever. So we kind of gave them a bit of a pass on it, but it's looking increasingly like the colossal effort they were putting into improving core product security might have just sort of gone away a little. And perhaps, you know, they're directing more resources towards, as a company, products and stuff that makes money.
Yeah, and it's that dynamic, really, that is the core of this all. If they were shipping less code, if they were looking at, say, all of the Office 365 or Microsoft 365 configurations and figuring out how to get this massive customer base to a great baseline, they would be doing amazing things for the security community. But that's not really what they're doing. You have one big umbrella that houses people writing and shipping code, some of which has had some really shocking issues lately. And you have, on the other side, a separate division that seems to be trying to monetize that insecurity. And that is a really difficult dynamic to grapple with.
It's a bit of a strange dynamic, right? And we should be clear, too, that like I know several, you know, many very, very smart people, very smart, well-intentioned people who work at Microsoft whose goal is to improve core products and, you know, do all of that good stuff. There are people there who are fighting the good fight. This isn't a criticism of them. This is a criticism of Microsoft at a macro level. I mean, and it is a complicated beast. You know, criticizing Microsoft is like criticizing the US government, right? There are different parts of it with sometimes competing aims, right? And that's something we have to be clear about when we're having this conversation. Microsoft is a complicated beast.
Absolutely. The one thing that is a little different, though, is that Microsoft is not a democracy. We're not voting for Satya Nadella. But it is really interesting to me in a kind of observing and sort of being buffeted by this dynamic, you know, both in the early days when everyone was just that Patch Tuesday was what made the security cycle go round, to now where really security as a market is primarily moved by Microsoft in a lot of different ways, both the startup side and the more mature, larger side that we're on. It's a bizarre thing to be a part of, but mostly because I think that this one organization wields massively disproportionate power. And so you wonder, when you're locked in to something like Active Directory that organizations have been locked into for decades, and then the new thing becomes, okay, it's AD Azure now. Lock you into that, connect the two of them together.
Man, let's get into the
massive attack service.
Let's get into the horror show that is ADFS a little bit later on. But you know, you have mentioned that they are a market maker, a market mover in security. I was hoping you could give us a bit of an example of that before we get into the spooky horror show part of the interview.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And I think ultimately, you know, every chief security officer works with a chief financial officer, and sometimes even a CEO who knows and might have extremely good relationship with Microsoft. So when it comes to demonstrating the return on investment, you look at that E5 investment and, we're doing a bunch of things that are in that bucket. You know, there's a bunch of software there like Power BI we can take advantage of. Why don't you go look at that? Wouldn't that replace 9 or 10 or 15 tools that you're getting from other vendors like us or CrowdStrike or Okta? It really is a compelling pitch at that level. So at the level of the PowerPoint that's going to the CFO, that's going to maybe even the CEO because of the size of the investment required, that is something that every security leader has to grapple with to at least some extent, with the very, very minor exception of those that have no Microsoft products. And for them, we are all very jealous.
Okay, devil's advocate for a moment, though. I mean, you're talking about Microsoft in that case very much from the perspective of how they're your problem, right? But like,
sure.
If you're the CISO, like, why is that a problem when you've got a suite of products available to you from the one technology provider, you sign that big purchase order, and then you've essentially got a catalog of all of Microsoft's offerings and you can mix and match them and whatever. So, you know, devil's advocate here, what's the problem with that?
I would state the problem is relatively simple. And that is that some of the products don't work very well.
I mean, there is that, right? Some of
there
them
is
do.
That.
We got to be fair,
thing.
But yeah. And that's even before you continue, that is one of the issues with E5, right? Like, so they've done really well on endpoint, right? Like, by all reports, Defender has become quite good, right? And their EDR solution is quite good. But then you get into some of these like more niche edge case kind of products, and they're not very good.
Yeah, exactly. And I would give a shout out to Sentinel. Sentinel's very good. I've seen a lot of people have some good results there. And,
well,
and
especially when you're using it with Defender, right? So
yeah, no, absolutely. And a lot of that does represent progress. When it comes, though, to just really Office 365 and AD Azure, so much of that has already been compromised by threat actors that, you know, they use it as their own infrastructure at this point. I mean, we published research recently, 59.8 million malicious messages sent from Microsoft gateways to our customers in just the last year. I mean, that's a shocking amount. There's millions of compromised accounts at any given point in time. So those are maybe debatably edge cases. Those are not the core things that Microsoft works on. It's not Office or Xbox or Windows, but they're still big.
I mean, they do have a problem with a lot of compromised accounts, but you have to deal with that whether you're a customer or not. Let's be real, right?
Yeah, no, that is entirely true. And frankly, the extent to which they drive the threat landscape, frankly, isn't just the compromised accounts. Yes, the compromised accounts provide attacker infrastructure, but the attacker playbooks also come from Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
What we're seeing with Proxy Logon right now, what we saw with Print Nightmare before, what we saw, frankly, over the years with macros, like just what they've done inside Office with macros has been shockingly ineffective. Yeah. And it's still the number one technique by which malware executes on modern endpoints.
And the frustrating thing is that is a fairly easy problem to solve. The extent to which you could disable certain types of backward compatibility in a default setting that would eliminate most macro threats, like it is just crazy how easy it would be for them to fix that with a change in the defaults.
Oh yeah, and my favorite example of this is XL4 macros became a thing last year, right? 1992 vintage, just absolutely extraordinary that, you know, those design decisions have continued to dig a hole deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And it feels like one part of Microsoft might be pulling in the right direction, but a much stronger part of Microsoft is pulling in the wrong direction. And it puts security people in the middle of that. And it's a very, very challenging place to be. You have to decide what things you can use, what things you can't use, what hill you want to die on there, and how much you want to be beholden to the organization that is really creating a huge part of your ongoing risk on a repeating basis.
This is where the conversation gets interesting, right? Because what we're talking about is a very solid sort of ideological and philosophical objection to Microsoft's decisions at a macro level, right? But the only thing that can change that is for customers to change their behavior. But as we've already established, there are actually some pretty strong incentives driving customers towards that. So, you know, give us some other good operational reasons why you just wouldn't become an E5 customer from your point of view.
Yeah, I wouldn't say even in all cases you wouldn't become an E5 customer, although E5 is a complicated decision and you want to make sure you can use as much of it as possible because it is expensive and getting more expensive. But when it comes to the things that really matter, there are going to be a subset of those that are just too important for a replacement level technology that is going to be buffeted by the internal political winds of Microsoft. And there are lots of cases to be made. And for clarity's sake, we're simply making one of them. I would argue that email is still the number one threat vector. That is one you should look very, very hard at relying solely on Microsoft for. And it is clear in the world's MX records that most large organizations do not. They rely on some other solution, whether it's a gateway, an API, or a solution like ours that does both. That does seem to be a relatively universal conviction. When it comes to other problems, though, it's a more complicated calculus. Longer term, you might trust them to build the things that are not moving targets, like a SIM, like Sentinel is a great example. It's not a moving target. And that is the sort of thing that I think Microsoft will eventually execute on extremely successfully. But where they have the need for speed, where they have an adversary, where they have somebody poking at their design decisions, the configurations, the new features they build, the complexity that they build, areas like identity, and I would say areas like attacks against people, mostly through email, but also through cloud, that's where Microsoft has performed really, really poorly over the last couple of years.
They do have a habit of letting stuff get stale. As much as they're going to do a great job on something like Sentinel, you know what it's like, man. The winds of change eventually blow through. They focus on the next red balloon that goes floating past, and all of a sudden you're dealing with a stale platform. I mean, I think that's actually a substantial risk of investing big time in Microsoft security platforms.
And that's the whole story of enterprise software in a nutshell there, really.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's the thing. You kind of do lose, if you go all in on Microsoft, you do lose that flexibility to select, you know, God, I'm going to gag saying this, but best of breed solutions, right?
Yeah, and that's the other thing with E5. As that eats your whole wallet, that's your ship. You're sailing on one boat. It does not have a life raft. And that's the good ship Microsoft that very smart security people in a lot of cases think of a good reason not to get on to begin with. But a lot of those decisions are being made right now.
Yeah, I mean, they're smart the way they do it, right? Because, just the pricing. Because once you start selecting a few of their good products, like E5 starts looking like it makes sense. That's the thing. And as you pointed out, like only you know, people only tend to use about 20% of the software available to them under an E5 license, right? So I don't know. It's just clever how they've done that pricing model where, you know, if you're going to use a few, you may as well get it sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a simple story. It's easy for them to tell to the C-suite. And ultimately, where security has always been challenged is explaining its own ROI. If we talk about, you know, the value of something not bad happening today, whether that thing is, you know, prosaic money loss like business email compromise or something that is a bit more impactful like a ransomware attack, most security tools have been very bad at explaining their ROI over the years. And this is an area in which Microsoft, I think, has exploited the cybersecurity industry's lack of a similarly crisp, simple argument to the C-suite when it comes to consolidation. Everyone says, oh, well, there's only 3 CRM vendors. Why are there 4,000 security vendors? Well, security is obviously a radically different problem, and asking that question betrays at least some naivete. And maybe longer term, we would love security to be built into more things. And maybe there are too many security vendors, but E5 will not actually solve the on-the-ground issues that matter day in and day out.
Well, and as you say too, the conflicting incentives, like one thing that I can think of is how you can use PowerShell and some complicated techniques to get some sort of control over M365 applications. Right? You can do that, but it's really, really hard. And Microsoft's solution is, if you're worried about that, upgrade to E5 and you can use our CASB solution, which is not the way to address the problem, right? Like, you should be able to pointy-clicky your way out of these very big problems that affect everyone. And they don't let people do that. And that's a problem.
It is. And those OAuth apps are a great example of platform-level abuse, where, you know, you find all kinds of interesting bypasses.
Platform level abuse like that they allow and that they allow. Benefits them by funneling people into their CASB products, right? And that's the problem. Their insecurity leads as a funnel to E5.
Exactly. Yeah. And it either creates risk, it creates demand for E5. And if you don't have, and I have no better way of phrasing this, a Swift on security or Kevin Beaumont level person on staff who understands how Microsoft is going to configure things in M365 and Office 365, you either become sort of a passive victim that becomes part of that attacker infrastructure with a bunch of compromised accounts that you don't even know how you got, or you become, again, that upsell candidate to E5. It's not a great place to be, and it's not really the behavior of a security partner, which is another really interesting question. What is a security partner in this kind of a world? What does the vendor owe you in this space? And it's a really interesting evolving question over time. And I would argue that part of it, and this goes to everybody, and we're not immune to this, nobody's immune to this. If we are not just taking security risk off the table, but also introducing new forms of security risk by shipping insecure code into important parts of your environment, we are not doing our job. And that is true whether you are a VPN vendor, that is true whether you are Microsoft and you make a whole host of products. It's true whether you're an email gateway vendor or a CASB vendor. If you're introducing risk into the equation, what are you doing as a security vendor? And that's one of those things that, because it's different groups at Microsoft pulling in different directions, it's really hard for them to solve.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the security industry writ large has a problem there. You know, that's not limited to Microsoft. But I think you've hit on something interesting there, which is, to me, I don't think this is part of some grand strategy, actually, at Microsoft. I think they've really just taken the brakes off a lot of product development, and they're not really incentivized to deal with that, because they win on both sides, right? They win because they're winning enterprise computing deals from the functionality side, and then they get to win on the security side as well. And there's no reason to sort of close that loop. But I don't think it's deliberate strategy. I think that's, you know, they're not James Bond villains.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. You know, maybe in the Balmer days, you might have had a James Bond-esque villain.
Long-haired cats, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Volcano bases and such. Yeah, but at this point, I think you're spot on. They've gotten to this place somewhat organically. Mm. But again, going out there and saying we're the largest security vendor on planet Earth, it has to rub people along the wrong way when they're saying that at the same time that there's nightmarish Privesk vulnerabilities out there that they've just created.
Well, the thing that really makes me laugh and die a little inside is when you realize that Microsoft actually operates a gigantic incident response shop. And you look at the sort of stuff they're cleaning up, and it's stuff that wouldn't have happened if they'd been doing a better job on the core product side, like often. And maybe that's not fair because, right, like skilled attackers will always find a way, but you do think it is like, it's a little bit cheeky. Let's put it that way.
Oh, absolutely. And some of the smartest and best security people I know are either current or ex MS Dart employees. They've done really, really good work on the ground, but think of the source of the messes that they're mostly cleaning up. And it starts to feel a bit wrong. And the other thing that, and actually I'll thoroughly anonymize this example here, but if I think of kind of what will actually get us off of this treadmill? As it really has been a rough year in security. There are very dispiriting developments happening all the time. Like even if you're in the relatively privileged segment of security that can invest a lot of money, could even pay for E5 to begin with, it's been tough. And the future seems like it's pretty far away for most organizations. But it's not like we don't know what that future looks like. If you're in an organization that, you know, God forbid, doesn't even have Active Directory because it doesn't need it, right? You have mostly cloud applications that use SaaS. You've got a bunch of identity and access management stuff you got to do in maybe AWS, but you don't need domain trust anymore. If you are all working from home behind cable modems, like no one needs to print nightmares going to the most deeply ironic vulnerabilities of 2021 for a whole host of reasons. Nobody's in the office printing anything.
Have you seen the Privesk involving the Razer mouse driver?
Yeah.
Doing that remote. Like, and this is the thing, like, why now? Still. Why?
Right. And that's the sort of thing that I think, just like you said, it's not an intentional strategy on the part of Microsoft to try and become the mega security vendor. It's probably not an intentional strategy to create horrifying vulnerability like that either. Like it's just the sort of thing that happens when the incentives are pulling in a different direction and you're a $1 trillion organization. But ultimately, I look at the things that could really be problematic, not just over the next 6 months, but over the next 6-10 years. And the one I keep coming back to is if you've got AD on-prem, and you got some stuff you can't get rid of or would be very hard to get rid of, and you're just moving to AD Azure and you're going to establish a trust relationship. Yes, Patrick, I am going there now.
Yeah.
The absolute horror
the
show of things
ADFS,
like ADFS.
ADFS is bad. This is going to take a few minutes.
It's a hot take, I know. But this is the sort of thing, though. If you end up with all the prem vulnerabilities, all the cloud vulnerabilities with the configuration sprawl of all the stuff that they build into Office 365, I do want to give a brief shout out to the team at SpectreOps that did some phenomenal research on how O365 handles PKI. It's shocking, honestly. And these sorts of kind of structural vulnerabilities in what Microsoft has built in things that enable ransomware and business email compromise and all of the things that we struggle with day in, day out to be successful, the way that that works from the initial access, Privesk, lateral movement, it's just, it's crazy making because it's happened the same way over and over and over again. We have this one chance in moving to the cloud to break the cycle, and a bunch of newer companies, you know, like a startup, why would you ever roll out AD?
Well, and even Azure AD, right? Like this is the thing that made me go a little bit nuts when I had that interview with Dirk-Jan Mollema, which, you know, you were one of the people who recommended I speak to him. But when he's like, oh yeah, you can totally run Mimikatz against Azure AD, you just pipe it all through JSON. And I'm like, oh my God, it's happening again. It's happening again.
That's exactly it. For those of us who've seen this movie the first time around,
yeah,
it's horrifying that we would get back on that treadmill.
Yeah.
And these are the sorts of things.
But hang on. What are the alternatives, right? Because before we got recording, you're like, yeah, ADFS is horrible and the CISO, you know, once you've got it, you can never get rid of it. What's the alternative, right? Because you need some sort of directory. And you were like, oh, well, people are using Okta. Okta isn't a directory. So like, how are people actually handling that directory challenge in a way that isn't superior just because it's obscure? You know, I always get the impression that the directory problem is that the directory exists, right? So how do you fix that?
I mean, it certainly depends how big you are and what you're trying to grant access to. Okta does have a universal directory, as they call it, which is designed to sit as sort of a meta object on top of existing directories. But you can use it actually as a directory.
Okay.
And there are ways to create the equivalent of a directory without creating domain trust, without creating something that looks like AD that happens to live in the cloud and doesn't unfortunately get rid of a lot of the structural security risk that we wanted to get rid of in moving to the cloud to begin with.
So there are alternatives. But you're saying Okta is, for a traditional enterprise, Okta's directory is good enough.
Yeah, and I'm not just saying that because Okta's our partner, and
you mentioned Amazon as well, right? Because they've got,
you know, Amazon's got ways to build this. You've got one login. There's lots of organizations that can give you that sort of directory structure, and that is something that I think a lot of people need to think hard about. Just at least do it as a tabletop exercise. Imagine a world without AD and ADFS.
And you're just making people get all misty-eyed as you say that.
I've
it's like imagining a world without COVID-19, you know?
Right, exactly. I've actually thrown this out and gotten, you know, the equivalent of rotting produce thrown at me too, because like, we cannot live in a world without AD. That's impossible.
Well, but I mean, look, there will be a lot of people listening to this who are like, oh, that Ryan guy from Proofpoint's talking up utter horseshit. Like, we can't get rid of this stuff. Like, what is the transition plan? What is the realistic transition plan away from Microsoft Directory Services? Because, you know, for the record, I agree with you. I mean, Active Directory is done. No one's really rolling it out. I mean, you don't really hear about too many new AD projects spinning up.
Yep.
You do hear a lot of Azure AD stuff going, but, you know, there is the problem where people are sort of bridging Azure AD to Active Directory via ADFS, which is just gives you the worst of both worlds, right? Let's be honest, that's right. A bad idea. But what is the realistic plan from transitioning away from using Active Directory?
It's a really, really good question. And if you are an organization that has a lot of on-prem stuff that you're not going to get rid of, the easy answer is unfortunately to actually just spin up AD Azure and then connect the two. What is a smarter way to approach the problem, and I've seen this work actually in practice a few times, so it's only 80% horseshit for most organizations, is to actually figure out what needs to live on-prem forever and just go full zero trust with it.
Yeah.
It should.
So you're talking about like identity aware proxies in front of them and
identity
things like
aware
that.
Proxies. Yeah. You can use overlay networks. You use zero trust network access is the Gartner acronym for it. And then you end up with this. It's not quite air gapped, obviously, because you do have IPsec tunnels going back and forth, but you have this cordoned off portion of the environment. And you can give people access to it in a relatively straightforward way. You do have to have some directory object. And again, ideally, you would use something more modern like an Okta Universal Directory. But again, if you have to fall back on AD Azure, that's maybe the one thing that is okay from a directional perspective. It will be much better to just have AD Azure only rather than AD on-prem talking to AD Azure. So that at least represents progress. I don't want to go full utopia on this, even though I will say my CISO friends that sleep the best are the ones that don't have an AD domain. They have strongly authenticated cloud services and have something resembling a directory, like ideally Okta's universal directory, but there's lots of different ways you can go there. They use YubiKeys. All of these sorts of things really put you in a great place. And if you think about it, it can even go farther than that. If you want to get really past the threat of ransomware, well, what about Google Drive? Those aren't files under the covers. It's all streams. It's really hard to ransomware Google Drive. So moving from the old to the new is hard. And no one should ever trivialize the complexity of getting rid of legacy. But there is a way to cordon off most of that risk and then make sure that it's not just simply exposed via domain trust to one hop away from every attacker on the planet. Mm. Which is what it is when you can fish your way in or get in other ways and have that domain trust to do really awful things that are hard to detect.
I think that ID-aware proxy stuff was really interesting because that was a technology that I familiarized myself with early last year when the pandemic was kicking off, because it was presented as a very easy way to start remotely presenting on-prem stuff. Now, if you're talking about something on-prem that presents through a web browser, that is absolutely true. If you were talking about anything that is non-web-based, the companies that ship this stuff say it's easy. It's not. Right. And I'm sure it's got better, but it's a project, not a weekend, you know?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And actually, one of the things in our portfolio that usually comes along with the CASB is a zero trust network access solution. And yes, there's the browser side, which is much more straightforward. If you're not using a browser, you're putting a VM into the data center. And it's,
well, and then it's
basically
a thin client horror show.
Well, no, it's not even, you're not even trying to do it like a Citrix style. You're just sort of, what we're doing is basically saying you have an identity centric policy where Patrick can only get to three applications that live in the data center. You're going in via IPv6 as on an overlay network. And then what I'm going to show you when I'm on the other side of that IPsec tunnel is only three different IPv4 addresses that you can actually get to. And it's an identity-centric way to build protections in. Those identity-aware proxies are one good way to do that, but the Zero Trust Network Access solutions all basically get you to the same place via a slightly different route. And you're right, it's not a weekend, but if you're trying to actually get away from some of the risk of legacy enterprise cruft, now's a great time to start a project like that, because it really, really will pay dividends in the long run.
It's funny that people are crapping all over zero trust as a meaningless marketing term. And I would agree that people are misusing it in marketing materials and whatever, and some people don't really understand it. But my definition of zero trust networks, I think, is a good one. And I've had people sort of argue with it and disagree with it. But my definition is, in a zero trust paradigm, in my mind, what it means is you're treating every network, every IP connection, you're treating it like it's going out via the internet on both ends, right? And just building accordingly. That's the only definition that's ever made sense to me. Treat everything like it's the internet, and that's what zero trust is all about. I don't understand why people have a problem with that definition.
Yeah, no, they certainly shouldn't. And the only thing I would add to augment that is that domain trust is just as effective an underminer of core zero trust as
exactly
just trusting what's on the network segment.
Would you try to use AD over the internet?
Weirdly, a lot of the architectures that we're building, though, if you hybridize like that, look like using AD over the internet. And that's exactly what you want to avoid. But going back to the macro point then, if you think about kind of Microsoft's role in all of this, if they're defining the architecture of the future and it's using all of the Microsoft products to both create the security risk, solve the security risk, and then create ever more versions of it as they never deprecate any older functionality, it's just not going to get better. So ultimately, that's where I think it's a really interesting point for the whole industry, as well as every single one of us as defenders or practitioners. It's a really, really bifurcating path, whether you go down one path where you try and get to what the cloud future was always supposed to be, where, yeah, you're still going to have risk, but it's going to be risk that you knew you had to live with, like your people doing things with data they have access to, and the cloud services themselves, which have been wonderfully resilient in lots of different ways. The other path, though, is kind of replicating the enterprise legacy cruft and not getting rid of the old stuff and then gluing it together in ways that undermine all those zero trust principles that we ultimately want to live up to. And that's going to be a really interesting path to try and secure. And I just don't see E5 helping people make much progress there.
No, and it is interesting. So say Microsoft is successful, right, in what it's trying to do. That means, the primary challenge is to companies like yours, right? It's to companies like yours, it's to CrowdStrike, it's to all of those companies that have aligned into this, by their powers combined into this super duper anti-E5 alliance. I mean, the reason that alliance is formed is because E5 presents the biggest risk to you guys, right?
Totally.
But what does that look like for them the rest of the security ecosystem. You're still going to have niche players. You're still going to have startups. And what does that look like? Does Microsoft then just go and acquire everybody who gets any traction at all? Like, you know, you just sort of wonder where it's all going.
It's a really good question. And I will say there's been some good consequences. And yeah, it's true. Market forces is what pushed us closer to CrowdStrike and Okta and others. But it did also make us build good integrations, right? We can see, you know, the people getting interesting phishing emails are what we call very attacked people. We can call Okta and create a group in the Okta Identity Cloud, and you can dial up authentication for those people or even kick off access reviews. And on the CrowdStrike side, it's similar, right? We, I think, integrate better with CrowdStrike than the different pieces of Microsoft Defender integrate with each other. Mm. And it's that sort of thing that will drive better outcomes and is frankly not a bad market force if you're weighing all of them in comparison to each other.
Competition is healthy.
Competition is healthy, but yeah, exactly. And we will all, as the anti-Microsoft alliance in this case, become better at working with each other and driving the same sorts of customer outcomes that Microsoft is selling on PowerPoint, where, oh, this stuff is all supposed to work together, isn't it? In practice, that's not always true, but it's certainly forcing all of the other security vendors to up their game in making sure that their stuff works together well.
That was a really fun chat, Ryan. I really do appreciate it. Thanks for coming on to share your thoughts with us on why Microsoft is bad, okay?
Always a pleasure, Pat.
That was Ryan Callenber of Proofpoint there. Big thanks to him for that. And huge thanks to Proofpoint for not only being a sponsor, but a very supportive one. Proofpoint, along with CyberCX and OstCyber, is a major supporter of our Seriously Risky Business weekly newsletter. So yeah, big thanks to the Proofpoint team for that. And that is it for this edition of The Soapbox. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.